Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 10.
Yes. As you know, we normally release our podcasts on Sundays. However, since in this episode we talked with the founder of the Big Apple Circus, we want to release it early in the hopes that we can help raise some money for the Big Apple Circus. They're really, really in dire need of people's help. And after speaking with a few people at the organization, we decided we release it today instead. If you know anyone or you personally can help, the Big Apple really needs your help to be saved. Oh man, this drilling is awful.
The drilling, I wonder if the audience can hear it outside or not.
They're building a new building right across the street from ours.
And it's almost done.
It's almost done.
But now they're just drilling into the concrete. So if you hear it in the back of the recording, our sincerest apologies. But we have a really interesting episode today. Two episodes ago, we were talking about Big Apple Circus and its current financial state. So we did our best and we got Paul Binder on. Yeah. Paul Binder is the founder of Big Apple Circus. He currently sits on the executive committee of the board. And we sat down and talked with him about the history of Big Apple Circus, his career, and the current financial predicament that they're in.
We also talked about the Tonys, which most of my predictions were correct.
Particularly about Leslie Odom Jr.
And David and Diggs from Hamilton. And it was the first time in Tony history where all four of the winners in a musical category were of color.
We recorded this episode on Monday. So you'll hear us talk a lot about last night's Tony Awards, even though now it's Friday. One of the things that Paul doesn't talk about, because it wasn't released at the time, is their new plan moving forwards if they raise the $2 million. The plan was released yesterday in an article with the Times Ledger, but I think it's interesting, particularly for the listeners who are wondering what will Big Apple Circus do if they get the money they're trying to raise. And I thought it was really interesting. The article said that Big Apple Circus is going to keep the tent at Lincoln Center and at Corona Park, which are the two places they play in New York City. And over the break between the two, which typically runs from January to sometime in April or May, they're going to do an arena tour.
I think going into an arena is super smart. It's the infrastructure's there. You don't have to bring a tent. You don't have to pay for all the costs of setting up and taking down a tent or restoring a site. It's super smart. But the problem with an arena is you have to fill an arena.
Yeah, it's a lot of seats to fill.
Yes.
But possibly they can go to more places if, you know, Cirque du Soleil usually plays an arena for 2 or 3 days at a time. Mm-hmm. So this might be an opportunity for Big Apple to expand their audience and play in cities and towns they haven't been able to go to before.
And it also will be interesting because they typically create a show for a relatively small tent. And now going into an arena, the show will then be much, much larger. You know, I mean, the show won't be larger, but the venue will be larger.
And presumably they'll still be building the show for the tent when it's at Lincoln Center and at Corona
Park.
Right,
that's what I'm saying. Like, is it the same show? Are they doing two versions of the show? It'll be interesting to see what happens.
If you're enjoying the show, if you like the podcast, please share it with your friends. That's how we grow our audience and find new listeners. You can use Facebook or Twitter or email or just word of mouth. Lindsay and I really do appreciate it when you tell people about the show.
And tell us what you like hearing about. It's helpful, you know, so we make sure to ask the questions that
you want to hear.
People want to hear.
And you can send us any question ideas, any particular guest ideas to hello@hideawaycircus.com. And thank you for the guest suggestions we got this week.
Yeah.
Seems like we're getting more every week. So please, please do keep sending those. And enjoy your interview with Paul Binder. Did you want to be in the circus as a kid or did you want to be an actor?
Wasn't interested. And was I? Yes, I was very turned on. I liked performing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the story's in the, maybe it's not in the, no, it's not in the book. The first Broadway show I ever saw was Where's Charlie with Ray Bolger. Where's Charlie was based on a play called Charlie's Aunt. Mm-hmm. Charlie's Aunt. From Brazil, where the nuts come from. I'm from Brazil, where the nuts. Charlie is both Charlie and Charlie's aunt. I forget the story, but he tells everybody his aunt from Brazil is going to visit.
It's almost like one man, two governors.
Well, where sort it plays
of. Two people.
It's kind of that style, but it was a musical. The, mm-hmm. What I saw was a musical. It's called Where's Charlie? And Ray Bolger, who I had already grown up with, mm-hmm. he was the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. Yeah. At one moment in the show, stepped forward to the front of the stage, and he danced. He was a great dancer, and sang. And then he spoke to the audience and asked us to join him in the song.
Oh, fun.
And the song was Once in Love with Amy, and to this day I remember, I do it in my cabaret act.
Oh, you do?
And I did it at the Lotus Club for Lotus Got Talent.
Do you sing?
Yeah. I hadn't sung in front of an audience after college. In college musicals.
At Dartmouth, right?
At Dartmouth. I did a duet with Michael Moriarty. Does that mean anything to you?
Yes. Who is that?
He was the original DA in Law and Order.
Oh, but okay.
Before Sam Waterston, yeah. Right?
Yes.
And you watched the Tonys last night, right?
Yeah.
So you see the Law and Order tribute that was James did.
That was one of the best things they did. That was so very funny.
Yeah, it was.
That was very funny. And with the shot of Danny Burstein.
Oh, my God. And like
so many times.
Seven different roles.
It was great.
Yeah.
Great.
Have you always had that entrepreneurial sort of, I want to put on a show bug?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. And the answer is yeah. Kids, let's put on a show.
Because we share an alma mater for grad school. When you went to Columbia, because we also went to Columbia, were you thinking?
Yeah.
Were you thinking?
As undergrads or as graduate?
Grad school. Graduate.
In what school?
The theater school for theater producing and management.
Cool.
But, you know,
but we met with the dean of the business school,
and he had something signed from you on his wall.
Hubbard,
does. Yes. And he was like, "So you guys are doing a circus? Do you know of a person named Paul Binder?" And we're like, "Do we know Paul Binder?" You know, and it was just so funny.
It is funny.
It's so cool.
Well,
he asked me that they have their annual reunions. You know, so the reunion classes all come in and spend a couple of days. It's a weekend. You know, it's great. You know, here's my contribution for the small amount. Believe me, it was a small amount. And
Did you know before you went to Columbia that you were going to use something from the business school to start a show? Was that
no idea? I had no idea. No.
So what was the appeal of going?
I went from Columbia and I went to work for Merv Griffin.
Is that under Julia Child?
No, it was after. After. Julia Child. I came back to New York after I had worked for Julia, And, you know, I went to school. I went back to school.
Yeah.
And then after that, I got a job with Merv Griffin. First working on Jeopardy, the original Jeopardy. This was before, what's his name, Alex Trebek.
Yeah.
And then he took me onto the Merv Griffin show, which at the time was just going to CBS Network opposite Johnny Carson. And... So I worked as a talent booker. He had me as a talent booker. Although my job was booking what they call heavy furniture, which was, you know, authors and politicians and, you know, people nobody cared about seeing, you know.
Like too serious.
But the long and short of it is, I think that story, I don't know which stories are in the book.
Yeah.
Never quote the weather to a sea lion. Is Paul's book.
Never Caught the Weather to a Sea Lion and Other Uncommon Tales from the Founder of the Big Apple Circus with a foreword by Glenn Close.
That's the full title.
That's correct.
Available wherever books are sold.
It's on Amazon.
Yeah.
That's
or you
I
can
it.
Go to my website, paulbindercircus.com. paulbindercircus.com and get a discount. You get a discount
there. Oh, exclusive for the podcast.
Yeah, and it gets signed.
Do you see Glenn Close's little bit about playing Hillary last night?
Very funny. It was definitely her, too.
Oh, yeah. It was. And man, you always forget that she's just this amazing singer, too.
Yeah.
And then she did that little thing. I was like,
well, that's how I met her. She was, I taught her how to juggle in for Barnum.
You did.
She had a juggle for Barnum. She in her foreword, she talks all about it. But we trained the entire cast, and I personally trained her how to juggle because she had a juggle in the show.
Right.
As she sang a solo in a single light.
I wonder if they'll ever revive that show soon. I hope so.
It's never been revived for Broadway.
No.
No.
And Larry Pizzoni, who taught you how to juggle?
Pizzoni taught me how to juggle.
Yeah, we had Gypsy on like 2 or 3 weeks ago talking about Larry. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gypsy's great.
Yeah, she is.
She's fabulous. And, you know.
And you two had a juggling act for a little while.
Not Larry. No, another student of his, Michael Christensen, became my partner.
I thought I read on a Wikipedia that you and Larry had an act together, and then you were going to go to Europe, and then he didn't go.
Other way around. Michael and Larry were going to meet in Europe.
Oh.
Decided he couldn't go. I mean, I think he was determined to go, but Gypsy's mom, Peggy, said, over my dead body you're going, right? And so Michael sent me a telegram. Any of you young people out there know what a telegram is?
I do. They're so romantic. Why don't you ever send me a telegram?
I'm sorry.
He sent me a telegram. Can you come? Right? I didn't even have the money for a ticket to get there. He was working on a hops farm in Kent in England.
Yeah.
For so he could eat, mm-hmm. you know, have a place to stay and eat. And it took me, I can't remember how long, a month or so driving taxis and newspaper delivery trucks.
In New York,
to put a stake together to get over there, right? And so I did. And we put a show together in a barn in Kent. First, we took it to Hyde Park Corner.
Oh, yeah.
Figuring, hey, that's where the crowds are, yeah. right? And we did our act, and we were passing the hat, and London Bobby walked up to us, very formal, and he said, gentlemen, would you mind stepping aside for a moment as I explain a few fine points of the ancient British law? And he took the time to tell us that soliciting on the Queen's property was not kosher. I don't think he used that word, but no, he was very polite. He was very polite, and he actually said, "Well, you can keep what you've gotten so far, but you know, get out of here. You've had enough." And I think we took it to Carnaby Street. Carnaby Street was very popular in those days in terms of crowds and stuff. But and then we launched ourselves. We got to Paris, and we went from Paris all the way to Istanbul. Juggling on the streets.
Wow.
Did you enjoy street performing?
Say that again?
Did you enjoy like the challenge of street performing? Because it's really a hustle when you're doing it, or at least it...
Did I enjoy it? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It was, and we got better and better and better at it. I mean, we really had a finely, tightly woven act by the time we came back to the U.S.
So was this after Columbia then?
Yeah, here I was with two Ivy League degrees.
I know, it's so funny. I'm thinking Dartmouth, Columbia, now here, right, juggling.
I'm standing there on the Bosphorus juggling for Turkish lira.
Did you know,
we had it all figured out. Gee, you know, look at all the dollars we're going to make. Of course, it never occurred to us we were going to be working in the local economy. So we never had dollars, you know.
Work everywhere, or did you change stuff depending on where you were?
Well, we worked in English where we thought English was, and then we worked in French, we worked in Italian, we worked in German. Michael was fluent in German, and all we had to do was change a few words around it. You know, we had a routine where, let me think for a moment, how did it go? Where I took a chicken and threw it, a rubber chicken, and threw it into Michael's juggling cascade. And he says, what is that? I said, it's a chicken. A what? A pullet. He says, well, pull it out. Okay, so that was the gag. So in France, what we changed it to, qu'est-ce que c'est ça? What is that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Ça, c'est un poulet. The chicken. En quoi? Un poulet. And he would say, prenez le poulet si vous poulez. The French loved that. We were butchering their language. We were the only Americans butchering their language at the act they thought was funny. And they laughed at.
How did you meet Annie Fratellini?
Pierre Atex, who was married to Annie Fratellini, and they were planning the Nouveau Cirque de Paris at the time. It didn't exist. And there it was. There we were on this TV show. And they were somewhere in the provinces, not in Paris at the time. They lived in Paris. And the story he told was all of a sudden he went like this, Ani, vieni ici, come here. And he pointed to the television, and they watched our act on television. And the next day we got a phone call from, a telegram. I can't remember what we got or how they contacted us. I don't even remember where we were. We were in Paris because we had done the TV show. And indeed, I think it was live, that TV show.
Oh, so cool.
What they call an émission in France, or did at that time, a live émission.
So they knew you really could juggle.
Well, they contacted us and said, would you come and meet, you know, and we met at Annie's apartment in Paris. And she said, we're planning this circus and we would like you to join us. We're doing these gala shows. Companies and organizations would have these shows, like Christmas shows. Mm-hmm. And they would have a little talent thing. And Annie and Pierre were doing it. And they asked us if we would join them as part of this. And so we did a series of gala with them. And this was all in what they called pre-whatever for the circus that they were about to start. And then we went home. We came home to U.S. And we got what did I receive?
Telegram.
A telegram is correct. I got a telegram from Annie saying, could you join us in the dates in Dijon in France, where we're going to begin the tour of the circus? And we figured it out. We said, yes, we could get there. And next thing we knew, we were touring France with the circus. And it was the Nouveau Cirque de Paris. They, of course, were the stars, Annie and Pierre. They had a wonderful comedy clown routine. They were clowns. And we did our act. And it was the beginning. It was like, oh, this is wonderful. Oh, look at this. The feeling that we got when we were in the ring from the audience was astounding. I kept on saying, this is amazing. It was like we were inside a dome of energy. Mm-hmm. That's how I remember the feeling. We got it. I love this. I kept on saying, this is wonderful. And we knew we were going to come back to the U.S. So the thought was, how about if we do this in the U.S? That's the story.
Really, and it just came, bites you, yeah, right?
Say it again?
The circus just like gets you and you're just like, I have to do it.
Yeah. So I came back and I proposed it to a friend of mine named Richard Levy. Mm-hmm. Indeed, he was the first co-founder of the Big Apple Circus. Michael wasn't even involved at that point. He had gone off to Seattle, I think.
Talked about it you were over in France.
No, we didn't talk about it.
We didn't at all.
I talked to Richard Levy about this. And I said, Richard, here's what we should do, and we could do this, and we could create the circus, you know. And Richard took some time and he thought about it. I'm not sure it was in the same conversation or a next conversation. He said, Paul, go back to Paris. But he began investigating the idea. He's asking friends and people he knew, whatever. And everybody said, this is a great idea. You really ought to do it. One of the people was Mimi Gross. And she just got so excited by the idea that she really turned them on and said, this is a wonderful thing. We really should do this. Let's go for this. And he began to see, and he began asking other people who, mm-hmm. as he began to elaborate on it and understand what it would be. And he got excited about it. So he wasn't sending me back to Paris anymore, but he really helped me start it. And at some point we contacted Michael. So Michael, you got to be part of this.
Why did you guys choose to do it as a nonprofit venture rather than a for-profit venture?
Okay. Two things. Because it would always have community service as part of its vision, and mission. And then we did the numbers. I mean, no way this is going to make a profit. We have to raise money every year in order and of course, excuse me, not-for-profit theater companies, they were there.
Yeah.
We were out here. And we structured it that way. We knew in order to have it as a single mission, Mm-hmm. The Big Apple Circus is going to be a cultural organization with a world-class performing arts institution and serving the communities in which it performed.
Why was that important to you?
I think it was a product of, first of all, my upbringing, you know, that community, that service was part of the belief of our family and, you know, in my community.
How did your parents instill that?
Lord knows how. They probably beat me. That's how. No, no, they didn't.
You will serve.
You will. That's right. You will serve. Richard and I were involved in, I met Richard actually in the Bay Area when I lived in Oakland and then went to the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And that's where we met. And so service was always part of the image. He came from the same kind of background, not in New York City, actually. He lived in, he was raised in the Washington, D.C. area. It just, that was what sang for me, you know? Even if I wasn't singing publicly, it was singing in my head. So from the beginning, that was the idea. We would have the first vision was to have an inner city school teaching inner city kids circus skills as a way of teaching discipline and teamwork and, you know, self-confidence and good self-image. And it works. I'm here to tell you that works. And we still have school programs. Eventually, the flagship community program became our clown care unit, which Michael invented. You know, Michael joined us early on. And at first, he wasn't even called founder. He was clown coordinator and this and that and the other thing. And then one day he said, I want to be called founder too. He wasn't really there from the very beginning, but it wasn't long after we started this.
Did you think about that? Were you like, oh, I don't know if I want to share
that? No, I didn't. And I said, fine. I want to be the co-founder, he said. Well, it's fine. I kept the title founder, and he was called co-founder for the longest time. To this day, I have to disabuse people. Don't call us co-founders. Just founders. That's okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
The other day, it happened the other day when there was a press release that went out. And I said, no, get off this co-founder thing. Just call it founder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are two founders.
Right.
They are founders. Yep. They don't have to be called. Excuse me, everybody. I'm getting very academic about this. But
can you talk about presumably the early struggle of starting a circus in New York and what kind of challenges you faced when you started?
Other than convincing people that it was worth starting.
Yeah, it was kind of this crazy idea. And here was the city in a financial crisis, and I'm proposing that we do a circus with community programming. Our first grant, actually, was from Chase Manhattan Bank. I think it was called Chase Manhattan at the time.
They gave you a grant?
They gave us, I think, $1,500 with which we could print our proposal.
Oh.
And we did. And one thing led to the next. The printer who was printing the proposal said, hey, this is really good. I know the people in the women's division of the governor's office, Governor Carey at the time. Mm-hmm. You ought to bring this to them. And we did. And we went to see them. And there was somebody in the room who said, hey, this is a great idea. It wasn't the woman we had made the appointment with. I remember saying, who was that lady sitting in the corner taking notes, Richard? Oh, that was Margaret Hyman, Maggie Hyman. I said, she's the one.
Right.
She's the one we should be talking to. And sure enough, we did. And she opened her Rolodex and said, oh, we got to contact this one. We got to contact that one and so on. And one thing led to the next. Anyway, we got $1,500 to print the proposal from Chase Manhattan. And then the first big grant was from Con Edison. We just kept moving ahead. You know, we're going to order a tent. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And Con Edison put in money to bring kids to the show and bus kids in and, as part of their community programming. Bingo, we were in business.
From the inception of the idea till the very first show, how long did that take?
You know what?
too long.
Who remembers? Yeah. No, actually, it was much faster than we had anticipated. But we had no idea. We had no idea if we were going to get through the first season. I mean, it was like, you know, and here it is, whatever. How many years later?
30?
30-something.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. One, but always on the edge. Always financially on the edge. And yeah. Here we are again.
Well, maybe you can talk about what's going on right now.
Yes. Let's talk about what's going on right now. In order for us to open at Lincoln Center this year, we have scheduled to be there opening on October 19th for our normal 12-week season, running through January, whatever the date is. We need to raise $2 million in contributions to mount the show, to do the pre-show marketing, to assure us the private performances that are scheduled to come in. Without it, we're not going to be able to open. And it would effectively close the Big Apple Circus forever. You know, perhaps the community programming would survive, even that becomes questionable. So we've actually raised $600,000 of that. So we still need $1.5 million. Yeah, if anybody has a spare $1.5 million, you could go to SaveTheCircus.org. Shall I repeat that? SaveTheCircus.org. Because that's a, what do you call it, crowdfunding site.
Yeah.
And, you know, that site has raised about $50,000 to date, which is good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a good start. And it's a piece of, and plus we have a whole lot of other pieces that are coming in, larger grants and so on. But we've got a long way to go, and we've got whatever, a month, you know, till July 15th, the latest July 30th, because we have to make commitments between now and then in order to put the show up.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be awful. The Big Apple Circus is going to stop because the public didn't come up and support it. They really should. Yeah. SaveTheCircus.org.
Yeah. That's such a big part of so many people. I mean, like, I actually started going to the circus before I went to theater, and then I got sidetracked into theater and forgot about the circus. And then I met Josh, and he reinvigorated this love of circus that my family had. And we went to the Big Apple, you know, and it's something that, you know, I'm 27. So I think we went when I was like 5 or 6.
The first time I went backstage at a circus was Big Apple. I was in Circus Mercus. And I don't remember. I think maybe Barry took, like, was our tour guide around backstage. And I was like, oh man, this is where it's at.
It's great, huh?
So I just wanted to ask sort of how it ended up in this position, because I think the website explains it a little bit, but I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about...
The major thing that happened, the big thing that happened was when the financial crisis hit, we had something like 24 private performances at Lincoln Center. Private performances were corporations... would buy out the entire tent for their clients and their employees and so on.
So you essentially had guaranteed profit for 24 shows. Yeah, income.
Income, revenue, yeah. What we call revenue. Earned revenue in the not-for-profit world. And that amounted to something like $1.2 million of revenue in a given season. Well, that's a considerable amount. What's more... the shows that were bought by these was blocked out on the schedule, so that corporate math.
Right.
The other ones began to fill up. Those were the available seats. Well, 2009 was already contracted. So that season, 2009-10, we continued to have that revenue. But immediately after that, 10 financial institutions did not come back. Well, there goes the $1.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, overnight, it disappeared. So we were suddenly in a situation where we were not earning the kind of money to support what we were doing. And they've never come back. What I should say is that the Bloomberg organization stayed with us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the banks, all of whom had taken TARP money, what was it? Something asset relief program.
Yeah, from the federal government.
From the federal government. Could not be seen buying tickets to a circus It was just...
It was like frivolous.
The optics, as they say, were not good about that. So they disappeared. Mm-hmm. And they never really come back. I'm hoping they still will. But so what began happening is we started taking on debt in order to, you know, keep our seasons going and so on. And then we got hit by a series of events that cost lots of money, lots of earned revenue. For example, there was a blizzard in 2011.
That's when I moved to New York. So, I moved at the blizzard.
All right. Oh, terrific.
Like, literally.
Terrific. Yeah. And there was we were in Boston and had to close down for 5 days, after the marathon bombing. We were right there in the center of Boston. Mm-hmm. And we were simply told you cannot perform. You cannot.
I'm from Boston.
Ah, okay. So you
know. I know exactly where you're talking
right,
about. Yeah.
Right. So that was a huge blow to our revenue.
Especially 5 days of performances.
Yeah, about 10 shows.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on tour, there was an ice storm in Atlanta when we were in Atlanta. Nobody drives their car when you get, you know, quarter of an inch of snow in Atlanta. Forget
right.
it. And there were ice storms. And then, I mean, this is just a series of very unexpected events. There was also a snowstorm in 2014 mm-hmm. on December 26th, which is the beginning of the best week, our biggest week of the year. Mm-hmm. It's the Christmas holiday week. Right. And we're at Lincoln Center and we sell tickets all week long, you know. And so all of those things meant we weren't earning the money we were earning. And so we continued to accumulate debt and put us in a hole. So that's where we are. We have no cash. Mm-hmm. As of today, are you all listening out there? As of today, we have no cash. We barely make payroll. We have a very reduced staff at this point, mm-hmm. Full-time employees. And when we perform, we have seasonal employees right. that we take on, you know.
I think I read in the New York Times article that your season, and correct me if I'm wrong with this number, but each season your show costs $11.4
million. No, we need $11.4 million in revenue in order
each
to make
year.
Up. That's right.
Okay. So each year for your
Doesn't
show,
cost
you
that.
Need, okay. Yeah. I was like, wow, that's a really costly show.
Right.
So you need $11.4 million in revenue each year.
To break even. Right. Right.
Because
and the entire organization is almost $17 million, right. including the community programming. But the budget is...
so you're operating...
That's seriously down from at our height in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and late 1900s. We were a $22 million organization. So that's a budget number.
Right. I mean, it costs a lot to run a circus.
Well, you have to...
And
yes.
a tent and a site.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And moving it was very expensive. Mm-hmm. So... What's happening now is we have a very viable business plan going forward. I don't want to discuss it, but it's truly a viable plan, which will be huge budget relief to the costs of the carrying costs. Mm-hmm. But unless we're able to open the new show, we can't. The new business plan doesn't work. In fact, it's as if it never existed. Right. So this. See this as an appeal for funding, everybody. SaveTheCircus.org.
Yeah. You don't have to give any details, but I am curious because on the website it did say, like, look on the generosity page for details on how we're, you know, addressing the spiraling tour costs. So
yeah,
I'm just curious, like, now that you've sort of at this position where what does Big Apple see as the things they can change to be more sustainable?
The costs of touring are high because we're carrying a tent, we're carrying bleachers, we have 32 loads of equipment, including all the lighting equipment and the sound equipment and the technical setup and so on. You know, it's a small show, but it's an enormously, it's a very focused, high quality production value show. So that costs a lot of money. And there are downtimes between performance venues. We finish at Lincoln Center on let's call it January 15th. We don't reopen again until February 15th, okay? We have been reopening in Central Jersey at that time. It looks like we're not going to be able to do that again because it's a very risky proposition because of weather in February in Central New Jersey. You get one snowstorm and bingo, you're in big trouble. Same thing as in Atlanta. People don't drive when it's snowing. Okay. And then our big locations are New York and Boston. We're 6 weeks in Boston. We're 12 weeks in New York. And we do very well in Boston. There was a wonderful review. This is a sidebar, everybody. There's a wonderful review back some years ago in the Boston Herald. It said, when the Yankees come to Boston, we hate New York. When the Knicks come to Boston, we hate New York. So also for the Rangers. Why is it that we love the Big Apple Circus? That's how the review began.
Sell Boston.
Yeah. Well, yes.
And that's a nice review.
And absolutely. We loved Boston. Boston always loved the Big Apple Circus. We had a wonderful following there. I attributed some of it to the fact that we got there at the beginning of April, and we were a harbinger of spring in a city that was tired of being cold. But it was one. We have a wonderful following there, I must say, and it was always great going to Boston. So, but between, let's say, New York City and Boston, all of a sudden there are 8 weeks before we reopen in Boston, and our fixed costs remain.
Right, because you're still carrying
all those full-time
the
show. Employees, yeah. Right? And so we have a plan that will relieve that. I am not at liberty to reveal it, but trust me, it's a damn good business. But
yeah.
Because Lindsay, am I allowed to say "damn" on a blog?
Yeah. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Damn.
The technical term is podcast.
Oh, podcast. Sorry about that. Of course. What am I saying? Of course. A podcast. But
I'm not writing all this.
After we heard that news, Lindsay and I were just immediately like, okay, well, what would we do if we were on the Big Apple Circus board, and I know Mary Jane was like, is there anything that I would just write her and suggest?
Yeah.
And one of the questions that I had was, why not do a new show every 2 years as opposed to every 1 year?
That's a very good question. I mean, for one, we have to do a fresh show every year at Lincoln Center, right?
Do you, though? That's my question.
Yes, because our audience is not going to come back a second time to see the show.
But I don't know. I think they might. That would be the proposition I make.
We had this argument because I think...
I hope you two don't argue often. Then.
We don't. Okay, but when it's about, we argue about circus philosophy and theater.
How interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I think my parents are like, oh my God, stop. But it's an interesting question because Wicked has been on Broadway, however many years, at least 10 years.
10 years.
And
they just recently celebrated their 10th.
Yeah. But it's interesting to see if people would go see the same circus show. Again.
Well, remember, Broadway is different because Broadway, a good deal of Broadway's ticket revenue comes from tourists.
Right. But okay.
That's a big hit show. So they come.
Locals.
Right.
Yeah.
We are very New York.
Yeah.
We don't get a lot of tourist business.
You probably have to do a new show.
Circuses come to their town. They don't need us. Mm-hmm. They don't come to New York to see the big episode. They come to see Wicked. Or Hamilton. Well, they're going to be a few
Hamilton.
Years from now. But I was lucky. I saw it early on. Whew.
Anyway. At the public.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't. We were there for the Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
When they opened up Broadway.
So in previews on Broadway and then in previews at the public, because I was like, I know this is going to be a big show.
Oh, man.
So I bought tickets real early.
Fabulous.
But anywho.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that audiences have declined in the past few years, or have they been consistently?
No, they haven't. This past year they did, which was really odd because it's a very good show.
I really like this year's show.
Yes, and it got it was a New York Times critics pick. By
Mark
the way,
Mark Lonergan is our good friend.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, this is a terrific show. We just finished the season, touring season
yesterday, right?
And it was a New York Times critics pick, and so on. I can analyze for you what went wrong, but we made less money this year than we did last year. It didn't make sense.
So do you feel like the quality
It does
show?
To me, but we can do that offline.
Yeah.
We ain't telling any of you out there what happened.
Everyone can guess.
No.
Another question I was thinking about is, how do you keep the show fresh? I think Mark definitely did a great job of sort of bringing the Big Apple Circus culture.
You're talking about Mark Lonergan,
the director of this year's show.
Yeah.
Did a really good job, I thought, of sort of maintaining the Big Apple Circus culture while still using a few new elements. You know, tap dancing was an example that I haven't seen in a while in Big Apple. And I'm wondering what that process, because you directed already so many shows, now you've seen so many, what that thought process is like a year or two out when you're like, okay, we have the next show. How do we keep it fresh? Like, what is that challenge like?
Well, this is interesting because Mark's collaborator is Joel Jeske, mm-hmm.
yeah.
Who has worked for the Big Apple Circus either in the show or in the hospitals mm-hmm. for 18 or 19 years. I mean, he intimately knows the Big Apple Circus. It's interesting, his character was called Mr. Joel. That was a tribute to our tradition. I was Mr. Paul. Michael was Mr. Stubbs, and so on. It's kind of the formal structure, the characters. Okay. And I think that he should have been, the other clown should have been Mr. Skip.
Oh,
Mr. Yeah. Skip, not just Skip.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Wonderful, by the way. He was wonderful.
In Brent Macbeth.
Yeah, Brent Macbeth is correct. Brent, the Scottish play, we actually say. But wonderful. He moves like a dream, Brent. He moves
just great.
Beautifully. And the character is a wonderful character.
It was his first time being in a ring.
Yeah. That is correct. But he did wonderfully, the two of them, and they had great chemistry and, you know, outstanding. But so what I'm saying is Mark and Joel essentially brought the idea, the structure and the idea. We had done a show years ago called, I forget what it was, but it was a tour show where we went around the world.
Uh-huh.
I can't believe I can't remember the name of it.
Is it in the book?
I don't think it's in the book.
It's not in the book. Part two.
Never quote the weather to a sea lion and other uncommon tales from the founder of the Big Apple Circus with a foreword by Glenn Close. You can get it on paulbindercircus.com. Okay. Discount. Signed. You will be sent it signed. And you don't have to pay for shipping. We cover shipping. How's that? Okay.
Wow.
How am I doing? Okay.
That's a good deal.
Okay. But anyway, I think this year's show, because of that collaboration, Mark Lonergan's direction and Joel's writing and understanding of the internal internals
working.
Of a Big Apple Circus, it's a wonderful show. It's a wonderful show. So, I first of all, I want to answer your question. I don't think it can have a 2-year life because we go back to the same places. It might have a 2-year life if it goes elsewhere.
Yeah.
That package goes elsewhere.
You guys have two tents, right?
We have two tents, yeah. One is meant for the hot summer.
That's mm-hmm. the white one?
White. And then we have a dark one, and which tends to retain the heat more.
Mm-hmm.
The white one reflects the sun, so it doesn't heat the tent as much. And the dark one absorbs the...
Mm-hmm.
the heat of the sun. So that's why we have two. Same seating, but you know.
How many shows did you direct at the Big Apple?
I did. I directed the first 19.
Dang.
What?
Man.
So but for you, because Mark and Joel, you know, this is our first one or second one, maybe Joel writing it, but for you up on the show 18, show 19, you know, where is your head at about where's the next idea? How do we keep that?
Oh, I mean, I was constantly filing ideas. I mean, you know, it's like, what if we did a this? What if we did a that? What, you know, I mean, we did a 1920s show. This past show is set in the mm-hmm. 1920s, the base. We did one called Jazzmatazz.
Oh, that's a cute name.
Yeah. And we did the Charleston. We did a lot of the elements that you saw in this show. What I'm saying is, you know, they were different ideas at different times. I remember there was one I wanted to do, which eventually became what we call picturesque. And it was a tribute to the painters and artists who have loved the circus, you know. So Toulouse-Lautrec and Chagall and Degas and Calder and so on. These were all artists who did tributes to the circus. Mm-hmm. And it was, oh, that would be an interesting show. Yeah, okay. And then... I went off to Europe and saw a theater board act, a Russian theater board act that was a tribute to Chagall. It was a Chagall village. The characters in the act were Chagall characters from Chagall.
And that was done with a costume? Is that how they were able to indicate?
They were costumed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were costumed right out of the paintings. Okay? And I saw this act and I said, they're it. I was back in the guy's trailer backstage as soon as the show was over, the boss. And I said, no, you know, we'd love it if you guys could come to join us in New York and on tour with us. And he was very interested. So it became the finale act of the show. That was the Chagall tribute.
Wasn't there a theater board act this year?
Yes, there was.
They were like flying, or they were flight of airplane pilots, I think.
Right.
Something like that, yeah.
They were.
The theme was flight of the number.
Right, flight.
Yeah.
The music was the Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machine. Anyway. I need an orchestra to do
next
this.
Time I'll have you back and you can just do your whole cabaret.
I'll bring Dana. Wait till you hear how she sings. But anyway, Mark and Joel were great collaboration, and they essentially brought the idea. Then they had to work it through and figure out what to do, and they had to understand how to incorporate the acts. And then the production team begins to understand, how do you costume this? How do you, what's the set, et cetera.
So I have to jump in here, because 2 years ago, you and I, or 3 years ago, had lunch with Mark Mitten.
Yep.
I don't know if you remember, but I was asking you advice of whether or not, because I wanted at the time to be like, how do I become a circus producer? And the best piece of advice you gave me that I really, really remember, and I wanted to ask you to bring up again, is this idea that people who are genuinely really creative are less defensive of their ideas, and that a sign of somebody who will be a tough collaborator is somebody who really fights for their one idea.
I've found that consistently to be the case. The truly talented ones submit an idea. You're a designer, and you put something in front of the director and the artistic director of the organization, and they go, I don't know, that doesn't work for me. And the talented ones sort of pick it up, crumble it into pieces, throw it over their shoulders, and start drawing again. Because they have, it's just one idea from a creative mind.
They're not worried that they can't think of something else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I find that to be absolutely the case, that digging in your heels or defending an idea says you don't have faith in your own creative process. And it's a collaborative, theater is wonderful. Circus, the kind of circus we do, which I can talk to you about another time, which is a very representative form of theater. Closest, in fact, to the original tribal rituals out of which all theater came, all performing arts. But, you can move in any way when you're a creative person. And it's always collaborative. There's a director, there's a producer, there are other artists on the team, and you're looking for how your ideas intersect with each other. The role of the director is to put out a show. The role of the artistic director is looking to oversee the entire thing and see if it's consistent with the vision of the organization, who the audience is, because the artistic director knows far better than the actual show director, how that audience may be affected. That's the role. So I played that role for all of those guest directors all of those years.
How many years ago did you step down from the artistic director role?
That's 2008.
It was the end of 2009 season. Just in time for all that stuff to land on their heads,
Bye, guys.
I'm out.
I got out before it. I've retained the title of senior advisor.
Yeah.
It's a good job, senior advisor.
And you're on the board as well, right?
They ask a question. Yeah. I give an answer. They ignore it, and they pay me. That's a good job, I'm on the board. I'm on the executive committee of the board, in fact, which is the smaller group that really makes the decisions as we go along.
So jumping around a little bit, I wanted to ask you about being a judge at Monte Carlo Circus Festival and what you think makes a good circus act.
Wow.
I know it's an impossible question to answer.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a judge at the Paris Festival many times. They don't call it a judge. Member of the jury is what it's called. And at Monte Carlo, I think three times at Monte Carlo. The first time was with Prince Rainier, and who was great. I mean, he was great, except you had to get up early in the morning because we had the meetings in the morning after you were awake till 3 in the morning the night before seeing the show, you know. And we had our meetings. I think I was on it three times. And then Princess Stephanie was the head of the jury later on. What makes a good circus act? Who the the composition is very important. How does it affect you emotionally? Mm-hmm. Are these things, these tricks that they're doing, are they special? Is it the same old thing you've seen 35 times before? Is it original? Does it have is it exciting? Does it build to a major climax? And the good ones do, you know, they're well composed. You know, is this a solo? Is this a group? Does the group, you know, work together as a team? All these questions come up. Does the music and the costumes and the lighting all fit together in terms of exciting an audience? Is it too long?
That's a good important question. That's one of the most important questions.
Boy, when your butt starts hurting, you know it's too long. You know, you're sitting there going, oh, okay, ready. You see that more in Paris than you do in Monte Carlo. Monte Carlo, they're bringing in the best acts they can find in the world at that year.
Yeah.
In Paris, there's a lot of young acts coming out of
schools. Focus on new.
Yeah. And the young people, the young acts, they're coming out of schools, or they're self-taught, or they're, you know, they come out of circus families. And there's a tendency for them to be too long. Mm-hmm. You know, they got to do everything they ever learned in this act. And it's usually bad for that reason. So you got to judge it based on that. Yeah. In Paris, there were categories. In Monte Carlo, they're not. You know, this is just, they're worth a gold, a silver, or a bronze clown, and that's it. You know, there are other smaller awards that are allocated. A few years, we had a Big Apple Circus Award at Monte Carlo. And you're there with other people who are good experts, you know. One of the problems is inevitably on the jury is somebody from the home country of the act that's in the show. Oi, excuse me, but right. It's always a drag. It's, you know, we don't need this. We'll do fine without that kind of bias. But I felt it was always an honor to be on the jury, to sit on the jury, discuss the acts and during meetings. You know, that's always interesting.
Yeah.
And there's really major disagreement. There's some. No, this act, look what they're doing. Look at the innovation of this act. Look at it as, you know, I tended to be in that camp. Mm-hmm. You know, innovation really matters. That's all. The discussions were always lively, you know, and the food was free. So how could you argue with
and
that?
And Monaco is a beautiful place to be.
Yes, exactly. And the hotel is on them. Right. You know?
So we always wrap it up with two questions. Yeah. The first one is we know the book you're recommending.
That's the book is Never Quote the Weather to a Sea Lion and Other Uncommon Tales from the Founder of the Big Apple Circus with a foreword by Glenn Close. PaulBinderCircus.com. You get a discount and free shipping.
And a
signed copy. Yeah.
Can you also recommend a film and a show that people who, that doesn't do anything, just something that you would recommend to people in general, doesn't do the circus, theater, just big, open, impossible question.
What's these two? What
a movie and a show.
Oh, man. I don't know.
Something you love.
Well, I love the Disney cartoons.
Me too.
I'm looking forward to the next. What's the next one? The Finding Nemo sequel.
Oh, Finding Dory.
Finding Dory.
This should be a lot of fun.
So then the final question is, had you not gone into circus or theater and that had totally passed you by, what do you think you would have done?
I have not a clue. Really not a clue. I probably would have stayed in television or gone back to television. But the thing is, I worked for Merv Griffin. He sent me out to San Francisco You won't remember, but I don't remember what year it was, even 70, 71. I think it was 1970. A group of Native Americans had occupied Alcatraz Island, claiming this was, you know, Indian territory, and they were reclaiming it for the for the Native Americans. And he said, "Paul, get on a plane, get out there. We'll have a camera crew waiting for you. Interview the people who are out there."
Oh, okay. Wow.
Oh, great. Okay. Crew met me. We got on a boat. We got out to Alcatraz. We did the interviews. And I had 4 days more in San Francisco. I was finished. The job was done. We sent the tape back to New York. It was up to them after that. And that afternoon, I saw the San Francisco Mime Troupe in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. I went, "Oh, look at this. This is fabulous theater," okay? And I said, "Boy, I would love to be in that company," you know? So I think it was before I actually left San Francisco, I set up an audition for the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Yeah.
That may not have been exactly what happened in that chronological. Like I say, I forget a lot. But I did an audition from them. By the way, I did a piece from a Danny Kaye thing. It was a Danny Kaye thing. I had seen Danny Kaye at the Palace when I was a kid, you know, doing his one-man show. And I was given a job at the San Francisco Mime Troupe. My job was to go back to New York, give notice to Merv Griffin, and move to San Francisco. That's all I had to do. It was like, snap, right? And sure enough, that's what happened. That's how I got into the Mime Troupe. It's where I learned how to juggle. Larry Pizzoni was my juggling teacher. It's where I met Michael. Michael Christensen was the head of the audition committee that auditioned me. Anyway, I mean, it's quite an adventure that it began at that point. Yeah. So,
all thanks to a bunch of Native Americans.
Well,
Alcatraz.
Yeah. Well, the answer is, what would I have done? Maybe I would have stayed in the TV business. It was good work. I wasn't, hardly was ashamed of it. I enjoyed doing it. But this was a much more exciting proposition to do that and to go back to being a performer.
Mm-hmm.
I love performing. One thing led to another. I will tell you, it was all about passion. One thing always led to another. Wow, look at that. That is really something special. That's really something exciting. Let's go down that path and see what happens. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Do not stay on the path." Something like this. This is, if I can remember. Walk off the path and make a trail. And that's what it was. It was like, "Oh, okay, well, that's exciting. Let's walk in that direction and see what happens." And then something would emerge and I'd say, "Yes, yes, this is it." And it was all about passion. It was all about, this is something that's reaching the audience in an emotional way that's very positive and will help people's lives because of it. They'll laugh. They'll have a good time. They'll forget for a moment their common grief. That's what Henry Miller called it, the common grief. And it's true. It works that way. What we do, the Big Apple Circus and the Mime Troupe did as well. So we won an Obie Award for a play we produced in the San Francisco Mime Troupe. We brought it to New York and it won an Obie Award.
Cool.
And in fact, that's where Michael and I began our juggling act together. We were assigned to drive a vehicle back from New York to San Francisco, the two of us. And we decided to do it by way of the Keys in Florida.
The shortest way possible. Yeah.
Well, let's just say wanted to be out of the cold weather. And we drove across the South that way. And in the process, we had put together a juggling act that became, was the first of our juggling act. We paid our way across the country that way. And that driving that vehicle back to San Francisco was the beginning of the Big Apple Circus. We just didn't know it at the
right.
time.
Well, thank you so much, Paul.
Yeah, this has been fun and a pleasure. Somehow make sense of everything I've said. And SaveTheCircus.org. The Big Apple Circus could go out of business unless we raise enough money in the next 6 weeks, less 5 weeks. We'd go out of business, and that would be very sad to lose the institution.
Yeah.
Very sad. Yeah. So let's end on a very sad note.
Positive note, because you're going to raise it and Big Apple will go on, but we need your help.
Just go to SaveTheCircus.org. Yeah. All the information is there.
Well, that was our interview with Paul Binder.
We hope you enjoyed it and learned some fun information about his singing talent and his background. And please go visit SaveTheCircus.org to donate to Big Apple Circus to keep it alive.
They really, really, really need your help. So anything that you can give, I think, would be appreciated.
And if you're enjoying the show, please share it with your friends on Facebook and Twitter. Tweet us. We're on Instagram. We know we're on all the social media. Find us, follow us. Have a great week.
Bye.